You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education issue review podcast, this one for the edition that covers May the 16th to the 22nd. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined today by books editor Karen Shook, news editor Simon Baker and reporter Elizabeth Gibney. We will, as ever, be looking at three or four stories from this week's edition. There's a splash on a remarkable victory for the University of Southampton over the Quality Assurance Agency that Simon will tell us a bit more about. Karen will give us the lowdown on what we'll find in this week's books section. And Lizzie reports back from the third World Conference on Research Integrity, which took place in Montreal earlier this month. But first, Simon, more on this, should I call it a landmark victory for Southampton over the Quality Assurance Agency?
Well, victory is possibly a strong word. What's happened is that they've become the first university to appeal successfully against an institutional review. Now, the QAA carries out every 6 years a sort of full review of every university or every higher education institution, where inspectors go in and look at the quality and standards in the institution. They produce a report. You can have various different grades of judgment. It used to be that you were either judged that there was confidence in the institution, or limited confidence, or no confidence. In fact, no publicly funded HEI has ever had a no confidence verdict.
Never.
No. In fact, there's only been one institution that ever got a no confidence verdict, and that was the American Intercontinental University some years ago. But it reversed that decision later, I should add.
Rather begs the question why that category was there at all. It was never utilised.
It's a good question, but I digress. the system changed in 2011, and now we have a different series of verdicts, which is about meeting UK expectations in various areas, including academic standards. And instead of these confidence judgments, you're either said to have met these UK expectations, you require improvement to meet them, or you haven't met them. Now, what's interesting about what's happened with Southampton is they were potentially the first Russell Group university to have had a critical judgment in one of these areas, i.e., they were told that they possibly required improvement to meet in one of these areas, UK standards in one of these areas, or didn't meet them. We don't know what happened, because in fact that review's been set aside because Southampton appealed against it. There's going to be another review. So this is a bit of a bombshell, really, because firstly, we could have had this situation involving a Russell Group university. We don't now. There's going to be another review. We'll see what happens. And secondly, no institution has ever successfully appealed against a judgment in this way. In fact, under the old system and under the new system, although when you had confidence judgments, you could only appeal a no confidence judgment, seeing as there weren't any.
They're pretty regularly challenged, though, I'd imagine, but it's that they've never been successful.
Well, no, that's not actually the case. I mean, I've checked with the QAA. There's only one other institution that's appealed against institutional review anyway, and that's the current system, and they weren't successful. That's an unnamed university or other institution of higher education. So this
is interesting. There's a lot of it seems to be unknown, unnamed. I guess the fact that this review has been set aside might still do some damage to the University of Southampton. Some will say no smoke without fire, we'll never see the details. Is there a risk it will still sort of...
I mean, we have to be very careful here. I mean, yeah. an appeal is only allowed if the QAA finds that there's been a deficiency of process or a perversity of judgment. So really, that kind of suggests that there was a real problem with this initial review. So I think it would be wrong to read into a successful appeal and come to the conclusion that there must have been something wrong, because there'll be another review and we'll find out. It's probably just got just as much potential to do damage to the QAA, really, because they've had an appeal against them. There's always been a lot of criticism about the QAA's processes. Jeffrey Alderman says in our piece that the idea that the QAA would dress down a Russell Group university with all its reputation, and the fact that It can attract researchers from all around the world, would suggest that the QA, something wrong with the QAA's process. We don't know. We're going to have to find out until the proper judgment or the new judgment comes through. They'll then publish their reasons for successfully allowing the appeal. But just very interesting that this has actually happened.
Yeah.
Some other universities, post-90s universities, will say, well, it's interesting that this has happened when it's a Russell University. There have been kind of critical judgments against other institutions, not Russell universities. And so why has this happened now? So I think there's going to be a lot of kind of questions asked. And it's come in the same week that questions have been raised again about standards in universities and whether the QAA, well, that's strictly the report by the Higher Education Policy Institute, didn't criticise the QAA, but it did throw up all sorts of strange statistics about the differing workloads that students undertake at completely different universities, which suggests that our system for safeguarding standards is maybe not what it should be.
Yeah, and there's more on that in your Leader, of course, this week. We'll report, of course, on any developments in that as and when they happen and as and when they become known to us. But moving along now, Karen, I notice your book of the week this week is on an issue particularly close to my heart, preventing unwanted spam emails. I sort of thought I'd ask very quickly before you give us a lowdown if anyone's had any interesting spam emails that they want to tell us about. I once got a fantastic pitch for a range of boxes that I might want to purchase from China, direct from the supplier. That came to my Times Higher email account, so I'm not sure what they think we deal in.
I get them more frequently than you do. I'm beginning to suspect that boxes, widgets of all kinds from Chinese companies, they know that I'm susceptible to these kind of purchases, and especially purchases in bulk, which I think may reflect some rumours they've heard about my shopping tendencies.
Yeah, yes.
Many of them are in not bad English. I know that we have a department here that spends their time engaged in digital defense against the dark arts, as our reviewer calls it, and yet still the Chinese get through with their offers of boxes.
Indeed. Well, tell us a bit more about this book and what else we can expect from this week's book section.
This week's book of the week is Spam, A Shadow History of the Internet by Finn Brunton, who is a very well-respected computer science, media studies, digital scholar in the US, and this is published by MIT Press, who have an excellent list covering this field. And it's reviewed by John Gilby, who is at the University of Aberystwyth and who has his own stories in that battle in the digital defense against the dark arts from basically the dark ages of computing. He was there when, you know, spam were sent in a few lines of text rather than, as he says, as email technology migrated and advanced, you get richer, bolder formats, more graphical messages, and much more graphic. In fact, the most famous kind of spam, the 419 scams, which is the Nigerian prince or other late despot of a far-flung part of the world engaging your help in a complicated business transaction, is not native to the internet. As Brunton points out in this book, and as John Gilby highlights, that had its roots in a postal fraud, which was perpetrated as early as the 1890s. I'm beginning to wonder, would it really be worth sitting there with the stamps and the envelopes sending these things out? And in fact, the amount of quill pens, giant checks, and all sorts of things, it must have been a lot harder. But
it must have worked. I mean, it must have been worth the time. Yeah, one hit, and
well,
suddenly the whole operation is justified.
Absolutely.
I know from my own spam operations that, you know, you just get one to...
Your own spam operation?
Yeah.
Really?
It's no, okay.
The sideline.
I'm making that up.
Is it you trying to peddle all these boxes to us?
I'm sorry, it's all me.
No, go on.
No, I was just going to say, you only need one person to buy it, don't you? So I suppose maybe it was worth it.
But the cost of the stamps, obviously now, all you need is a server. I think you mentioned earlier, Simon, that you received a very interesting piece of email that was not necessarily spam, but could have been.
Well, I suppose, yeah, it's open to interpretation. But I did receive an email once asking if a quite well-known English publicly funded higher education institution was actually legitimate.
Was so, a real institution.
Yeah, it was a real institution. So somebody asking me from for some advice from India, I think. So
a lot of power you had there over the income of that particular institution.
Yeah, and I can't obviously name that institution. They seem to be doing all right though.
So very good, that's
obviously
all.
My advice didn't work.
So in the rest of the book section this week, Philip Kemp, who is one of our regular film journalism academics, writes about the US movie industry and Hitler. Perhaps surprisingly to those of us who think of Hollywood as being part of the stalwart fight against the Nazis, and certainly they had a very good war for the next 7 or 8 decades. They weren't too keen on standing up against Hitler at the time, and in fact there was apparently a lot of influence from the Nazi government in Hollywood making sure that nothing critical was said, and it was only a few independent films and left-wing organizations who raised the alarm about it. The other book I think is worth mentioning for higher education buffs would be that we have a review this week of Luke Ferry's book On Love, A Philosophy for the 21st Century. Now, he is not only a French philosopher, of which the numbers are legion, of course, for anyone who watches academic publishing, their work rate is astonishing, but he was also Minister of Education under Jacques Chirac, and much discussed for having been an academic who is famed never for having done any academic work whatsoever at the institution he was at. And there were many arguments advanced at the time that this was a perfectly reasonable thing, that one should not be at one's university at all. Perhaps the fact that the subject of this book is called On Love leads one to imagine what he was doing in the interim. I'm not sure if Jacques Chirac was involved. But that was reviewed by Jane O'Grady, who's a lecturer in philosophy at City University London and the London School of Philosophy, an interesting institution that is related to higher education, but in a way aside from it, when we've been talking about free and non-traditional higher education institutions. The London School of Philosophy is one that has drawn in a lot of academics from other places, notably Birkbeck and other London institutions, offering, in all respects, a university-level course of study, but outside of the regular system.
Interesting as ever. Well, speaking of France there, Lizzie, actually, I presume you were heading over to France because you'd been spending quite a bit of time on the phone speaking in French. It turns out you were heading out to Quebec, where you were last week. You went over there for the World Conference on Research Integrity. How was it? What was discussed?
Well, it was an absolutely fascinating conference, actually. So this happens every 2 years, and it started a few years back. And at the beginning, it was just trying to convince people that misconduct was happening at all in research, that there was any kind of a problem. Everyone thought, oh, it's these few bad apples who come up with these crazy stories, how they'd try and defraud everyone. But there's slowly becoming somewhat of a realisation that actually this is something that might be endemic to research in all kinds, and whether that's because of the pressures, incentives. I mean, it's really interesting. They went into some of the psychology behind it all. But there's a real growing movement of people who are trying to fix this problem, because the understanding is actually maybe research would take an awful long time if it was going to correct itself, and an awful lot of money might be wasted, and this is a problem that we really need to tackle head on.
Yeah, some of the suggestions in your piece sound quite expensive. Regular auditing of university research labs is the top line that you're going.
The idea of that, though, is actually overall to save money, it sounds to me. So you do these random little checks. The idea is if there's a chance that you might be checked, that will sway you in a very subtle way in the work you do. And actually, when they do these big investigations, we had the big Starpool case of in social psychology, you know, that probably costs hundreds and thousands of pounds to investigate, whereas you could do some quite simple checks. So this is Michael Farthing from the University of Sussex, who he's vice chair of the UK Research Integrity Office, and he was just saying that having some kind of process whereby people get checked up upon, they will have some incentives to carry out less research misconduct, and that overall that might serve the system a bit better.
The analogy he uses is speed cameras. My only concern about that is, of course, with speed cameras, everyone knows where they are, so they just avoid them. These would be random checks, wouldn't they?
That's it. Being a good scientist, well, he actually brought out the research. He said there'd been a Cochrane review on speed cameras, and even though people do avoid them, they overall reduce the speed and they reduce fatalities. So the question's obviously is the analogy
back to it with some evidence.
Directly translatable. But I mean, it
is. We should point out that we don't encourage people to learn where speed cameras are and avoid them in the way that Simon clearly does in his spare time.
That's very responsible.
I've never had any points on my license, so I'd just like to have that.
But it's interesting because some people are advocating methods like this, and we also mentioned Elizabeth Irons, who's trying to introduce an initiative about testing biomedical research to see if academic work is reproducible in pharmaceutical labs. But then on the other side of the spectrum, we have huge groups of people who are trying to encourage better education. So whether this is a problem that we could tackle at its source, whether this is the fact that graduate students, PhD students, postdocs could be trained better, and you know, if there could be more institutions, you know, giving a message from the top that says this is not what we do here, and if that would have any impact. That's a huge market, a business really out there, of introducing these, you know, online courses and sometimes in-person courses. And that was another theme kind of running through the conference, was a lot of people asking, does that actually make a difference? You know, do people know that these things are wrong already? And will any extent of being educated in good research integrity, would that make a difference? That's a big question mark, I think, left hanging.
Yes, the write-up is on page 11 this week from that conference, well worth a look. Before we go, I should tell you about a couple of other features we have this week on misconduct. In fact, our very own Paul Jump writes on PhD plagiarism in Germany, Eastern Europe, and indeed beyond. There's a particularly interesting section on how allegations of plagiarism have been used as political weapons to unsettle opposing political parties. It's quite a fascinating read. And we also have John Carg, who's an assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Massachusetts, at Lowell. He asks if you've yet encountered your worst student ever. And I'm sure that will get some of your minds ticking listening out there as well. Worth a look. And I should point out our designers did some sterling work on that piece as well. But until next week, that's the end of the Issue Review podcast. You can discuss anything we've been speaking about on Facebook, on LinkedIn, on Twitter, in all the usual places, and of course on timeshighereducation.co.uk. And we'll be back next week.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.